From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Bill Flanagan, an executive vice president of MTV Networks. He's written a new novel satirizing reality television and cable TV. Also, we talk with British singer-songwriter Teddy Thompson about his new album of country songs and about being the son of two singer-songwriters, Richard and Linda Thompson. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews two new DVD sets of shows that debuted last year, Friday Night Lights and Heroes. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Bill Flanagan, is an executive vice president of MTV Networks. He also contributes pieces about music to CBS Sunday Morning. His first satirical novel, called A&R, was about the music business. Now he's written a new satirical novel about another world he's very familiar with, cable TV. It's called New Bedlam. The story starts when a successful TV executive ends up in a reality show scandal and is forced out of network TV. To salvage his TV career, he takes the first job he can get, running a group of small-time New England cable channels owned by a man who made his fortune selling cars. He's divided his three low-budget stations among his three dissatisfied children. There's the arts channel that features pretentious documentaries and performances, the comic book channel that features shows about superheroes and geeks talking about them, and a boomer rerun channel, which devotes a lot of time to showing the father's favorite program, Bonanza. Since Bonanza figures so prominently in the book, I asked Flanagan if he grew up with the show.
Sure, didn't we all? Sunday night at 9, you know, the toughest decision you had to make as a kid in the 60s was how to fill that half-hour gap between the end of Ed Sullivan and the beginning of Bonanza. And then the Smothers Brothers came along, and we all started growing our hair and listening to The Who, and the Cartwrights kind of faded away. But, you know, I think that aside from the fact that I do have this latent catalog of useless information that I picked up as a child watching Bonanza, and I wanted to put it to use, there's also the fact that it is a book about family, and it is a book about the mythologies of families and grown children and their parents and the grief and heartache and laughs that they cause each other. And I thought that in a way Bonanza was a pretty good metaphor. That's the ideal family. That's the perfect impossible relationship where the three grown sons are all handsome and heroic and straight shooters and the father's a great man and they all ride off in the sunset together at the end of every episode. So
they're all unmarried and they devote all their attention to their father.
Well, you know, we don't know what was going on down among the cattle lowing in the field at the Ponderosa, and we don't want to know. But certainly the sons on Bonanza had a filial devotion, which, again, The Godfather's kind of the same story. You know, there were some wives off scene in The Godfather, but it's basically the same scenario, the powerful father and the three sons, and the middle one's a little goofy, and the oldest one is the toughest, and the youngest one, who they don't pay that much attention to, ends up being the one to take over the father's chair. But again, it's also the story of the Kennedys. And that's not fiction.
You actually have a long passage about Bonanza in your novel. Do you want to read a couple of lines from it?
Sure. This is Dominic King, the nasty old dad who owns the company and tortures all his children, who is insisting that they put Bonanza reruns on their would-be hip channels, and the kids really don't want to do it. And Dom says, "That's a show about family. And it's not some schmuck with no job riding a horse from town to town. It's not about a cop who lives in some house no cop could afford who gets shot in the shoulder every week and never takes a bribe. It's not some nonsense about a talking pig or a talking mule or a talking car or my wife's a witch or my wife's a genie or my wife's a mule or any of that foolishness. No. Bonanza is about a man who's made a lot of money and he's not ashamed of it. And he's been married many times, which is his prerogative." And Kenny, the son, says, "Ben Cartwright's wives died, Dom. He didn't cheat on them and get divorced." "So he says," Dom declared ominously. "You don't know the real story."
That's great. And that's Bill Flanagan reading from his new novel, New Bedlam, which is a satire about cable television. Now, the TV executive who is hired to take over this kind of mom-and-pop cable network, he's best known for the reality shows he created.
That's right.
One of them was called I'll Eat Anything. What was that about?
I'll Eat Anything. We don't really say what I'll Eat Anything was about, but I think it's one of those good titles like Desperate Housewives that pretty much tells you the whole story. That's where Bobby began his ascent at the network. He found a series proposal called I'll Eat Anything that was in turnaround from daytime, took it to primetime in the summer, and it became a sensation. And from there, he began his rapid ascent. And what sinks him at the big broadcast network is that he's involved with a series called Lookers, which, you know, I assume is some kind of beauty contest. I'm sure it has a perverse angle. But there is a scandal that erupts when it turns out that the sweet girl who was the season finale contest winner on Lookers had not actually gotten the most votes. It was the mean girl, and someone cooked the books so that the audience would get the result they wanted. And we never really say if he's guilty or not, but Bobby is the guy who's sitting there when they need someone to throw to the posse. So he takes the rap, he's fired, and his life is over at 33. He's spent his whole career climbing up through the big broadcast network, and now he's sunk.
Well, you know, certainly know something about reality shows. MTV does a lot of them. What do you, because you make fun of shows like that in your book of reality shows, what do you think of them? Because you oversee some of them in some way.
Well, you know, I think, first of all, MTV created the genre with The Real World, mm-hmm. and that's still going strong. And I think that was a show that was and is very compelling. I mean, you know, not everybody's going to like the same thing. That's true in restaurants, and that's true with baseball teams.
I'm just going to stop you and give a shout-out to, like, the Loud family as a preceding reality.
Well, I think that's a slightly different thing, because the Loud family, you know, in a way that's true, but that's also a documentary where somebody went in with cameras and followed uh-huh. someone for a long time and then spent a year editing it.
Oh, as opposed to casting for people to be in it?
Yeah, I think it's a little different. I think that, you know, I'm sure we could go back and, you know, probably to the invention of the movie camera and find examples of things that were kind of like reality shows in that they were real life, you know, they were documentaries. But I think that The Real World sure began the current current dominance of reality on TV. It was a while before the broadcast networks condescended to pick up the form, you know. But it certainly prospered on MTV and then other cable channels and then finally made it to the networks. But then, you know, again, I think a lot of the people at the networks are people who started at MTV and VH1 and other cable channels.
How did MTV go from music videos, you know, being the bread and butter of and the kind of identifying factor of the network to it becoming more about reality shows?
Well, it's a mix of things. You know, there's still a lot of music on MTV, and there's a tremendous amount of music on VH1, and there's almost nothing but music on CMT. But, of course, what really happens is that MTV, VH1, CMT, and all our other channels are very, very driven by the audience. We listen to the audience. We, I think, realized early on that you can't, it would be disaster, especially for networks that are geared toward teenagers and college-age people, for the people running it to say, this is the way we do it, this is the way we do it, this is the way we do it. You get locked into the way it's always been done, and the way it's always been done is death. So you follow what the audience is enthusiastic about, you follow what the audience cares about, and the audience tells us very quickly and very loudly when they don't like something. And the fact is that the audience's enthusiasm and what the audience is interested in changes every few years, just as the new class of college students changes every few years. And we reflect that. You know, we'll try something, maybe in some corner at 11 o'clock on a Sunday night, and if it explodes, if the audience says more of this, then they get more of that. And at the same time, in my experience, when you try to force something that you think is good for them down their throats, they'll tell you real quickly that, you know what, I'm in school all day. I don't need to be in school when I come home.
What's an example of a show like that?
Well, on VH1, about 10 or 12 years ago, we were doing, and I was involved with a lot of great shows, one still on the air, Storytellers. And we had Legends, and then Behind the Music, which Jeff Gaspin came up with, and a lot of great success with very music-oriented series. And someone came in with a notion for a show called Classic Albums, which would be the making of and sort of dissection of and story of a great record album. Let's do The Band. Let's do Songs in the Key of Life by Stevie Wonder. Let's do Graceland. And as a music nut, I was wildly enthusiastic about that. We funded the show. We were involved editorially, and I still think it was great. It was a great series. But it was too high and inside for the audience. It was further than they wanted to go. They really weren't that interested in how the bass track was constructed or, you know, sitting at the mixing board and watching the producer move the faders up and down. So, you know, the audience tells you. The audience says, you know what, this Behind the Music thing with the true tragic story of the captain and Tennille or how Nikki Sixx almost overdosed, that's great. We enjoy that. We love it. We'll watch it over and over again. This bit where you're, you know, sitting with Robbie Robertson watching the composition of the night they drove Old Dixie down, Why don't you guys just take that home and watch it among yourselves?
How frustrating do you find that?
Well, you know, I think it's kind of like if you were running a restaurant and you thought that the Cajun shrimp was just the greatest thing you'd ever come up with, and people kept ordering the steak. Well, at a certain point, you know, we're not here to be dictators. We're not here to stand up in front of the class and tell them what their assigned reading is. You know, we're here to serve the audience.
My guest is Bill Flanagan. He's an executive vice president of MTV Networks. His new satirical novel is called New Bedlam. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Bill Flanagan, is the author of a new novel, a satirical novel about cable TV called New Bedlam, and he's also an executive vice president at MTV. And since we're talking about MTV, there's a paragraph about MTV in your novel that I want you to read from page 184.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I really went back and forth on whether I wanted to mention MTV in the book, but this is a bit where an old network newsman is talking about how MTV changed the visual vocabulary of television, and there was just no way to get around it. The fact is, this is an influence MTV had, and to try and cop out of it by not mentioning the company I work for would have been really phony. So here we go. MTV had changed the vocabulary of television. Even here in the stuffiest old corner of the network news division, Weekend Daylight, the young producers were frightened to hang on a human face for more than 5 seconds without jumping to a shot of something else. Dash told friends from the old days that if he happened to say on camera that a boy at the ball game was eating a hot dog, they'd cut away to a 1 second shot of a hot dog. To everyone over 35, the MTV vocabulary was one of many editing styles, and a silly one at that. To directors under 35, it was simply the way TV was supposed to look. The new assumption was that the broadcaster's job was to click before the viewer could, to outdraw his remote control, to skip a second ahead of his tiny attention span.
Given that you think that there is this generational divide in terms of shooting styles, it's an interesting paradox for you because you're probably in your 50s?
I'm 52.
Okay. And so you're pre-MTV in terms of your TV genes.
Yeah, that's true. That's right.
But you're programming for the post-MTV generation who have, as you point out, a different sense of like what the pacing and editing on television should be. So how do you compensate for being on the other side of the generational divide?
Well, I think you learn as you go, don't you? I mean, it's not as if I hadn't been watching TV in the meantime, and it's not as if I haven't learned a lot from working at the company. And of course, also, if you sit in an editing bay, then you follow your instincts. You know, you say, I think that this is lingering too long, or I think we can hold on this face for a little bit longer. It's you very much make it up as you go along. You respond to your own enthusiasms first. But like everyone, I have been changed by the way the editing of TV has changed, regardless of how old you are. You know, people who are 70 years old have been changed. If you look now at TV shows from the mid-60s, if you look at I Spy, for example, which is a great old show, it's astonishing how slowly it moves. You just can't believe it. I saw an episode of I Spy not too long ago where Kelly and Scotty were being held prisoner and they were playing cards in the cell while they were waiting for the guards to come and open the door so they could punch them in the nose and escape. And they sat there playing cards for what seemed like forever. You know, I mean, maybe it was 2 minutes. But these days you would never do that. If you look at old TV shows, if someone says, now we're going over to Joe's house, there has to be a shot of them driving in the car and getting out at Joe's house and knocking on the door. Now it would just cut from one place to the other. Everyone has been changed by that. None of us are still looking for that old, slow-moving kind of style. We've all gotten used. We've all made the change together.
One of the characters in your novel, Dash, is a local newsman close to retirement who feels like he's kind of at the end of the line. But he's asked to come into this cable network that the TV exec has been hired to take over and refurbish.
Yeah.
So you have a great description of Dash, the close to retirement newsman.
Yeah, Dash is in this scene, just finished taping his Sunday morning segment for Weekend Daylight, which is kind of the end of the trail. You know, there isn't really anywhere left to fall. Dash never became the anchor, and now he's close to retirement age. So Dash left the studio to the usual compliments from Rudy and the makeup woman and the usual silence from the crew. He went into the men's room and scrubbed away his tan. There were 8 orange paper towels on the side of the sink when he was clean. There were network stars not much older than Dash who wore their makeup all the time, even on airplanes and in the street. What began in their 50s as no time to wash it off became in their 60s a habit. They put on their war paint in the morning, as soon as they shaved, struggling to look as they had when they first became anchors. They froze themselves in the face they had worn when they peaked. With each year, their bodies shriveled and their heads dilated. In real life, they looked like light bulbs on sticks. But they did not spend much time in real life. They lived on television, and on television they looked ageless. Those old lions might be snickered at by their staffs, but they were untouchable. They had their primetime magazines and news specials. They had contracts worth millions of dollars. They put their names on ghostwritten bestsellers. They were in demand as commencement speakers and at journalism schools. Dash had never cracked that club. He had been a local star as an anchor in Boston and D.C., and when he finally moved up to the network in the 70s, he got plenty of airtime. He did some weekend anchoring, too, but he had no illusions about his prospects now. Doing essays on the weekend edition of the early morning show was the last stop before the train ran out of track.
Is Dash based on someone that you knew?
A little bit. Dash is, I mean, this fellow was never quite in that position, but my father's best friend when I was growing up was a broadcaster named Arch McDonald from Boston, who was the anchor of the evening news in Boston from 1948, when he and WBZ made the transition from radio to TV, and he stayed there until the 70s. And one of the things about Arch, who we saw every weekend and who went on vacation with us every summer, was he was very, very courtly. He was really, he could hit his thumb with a hammer, and he would not use an obscenity. He'd been trained that way from radio and live television, you know, at a time when a slip like that could have ended your career. And he was just genuinely a very kind, nice man. And it was interesting to me as a kid because he knew the Kennedys really well. He'd done the first TV interview with JFK when he was a young congressman. He had met all of the powerful figures of the 60s and 70s. And yet he still had, as smart as he was, a kind of naive view of the world, a very old-fashioned patriotic view. He was completely stunned that Nixon would lie to the country. He couldn't get over that. He was of that greatest generation, and he took things very seriously. And I thought that someone like Arch would have had no place in the current TV world. He was a little too much of a gentleman. And, I do pieces for CBS Sunday Morning up at the 60 Minutes studios, and I have to say that there is around that place a little bit of that old courtliness and just sense of good manners and being a gentleman that's almost gone out of television. So I think with Dash Ryan in this book, I just kind of wanted, first of all, I thought it would be funny and dramatic to throw someone like that into the kind of sleazy world of King Cable. But I also a little bit wanted to pay tribute to the time when network news people were really dignified and they were almost like a little bit of a priesthood.
The one of the main characters in your novel starts off as a network executive, and he says that the title of vice president has been so kind of deflated in importance because, like, by the 1980s, the number of network vice presidents expanded to where it seemed like there was a vice president of paper cups and a vice president of parking spaces.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, you're an executive vice president at MTV.
I know. Well, who's benefited more than I? You know, I mean, Hemingway drove an ambulance to find material for his book. All I had to do was sit around and negotiate unwarranted promotions.
So do you feel like your title is inflated?
Well, so is my salary. my wife would say, so is my ego. This is just the world we live in, and I'm describing the world we live in.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's good or bad. I mean, it's good for me personally, I suppose. But yeah, we all have these kind of impressive sounding titles that I sometimes think are there so that when we get fired, we can have better looking resumes.
One more thing. One of the characters in your novel says that he really needs a low impact Monday. And that's an expression I've never heard. And I think it's a great expression. I can really use a few low-impact Mondays myself. Did you make that up, or is that an expression everybody except me knows?
No, I think I made that up. I think I made that up. We can only hope it passes into the vocabulary. I think that there have been times in my life when I have sat in my office with an ice pack on my head and just said, low-impact Monday, low-impact Monday. It means try to schedule as few meetings as possible for Monday, make as few decisions as possible on Monday, and don't commit to do anything Monday night. Just get through Monday, and by Tuesday, you'll be back in the swing of things.
Bill Flanagan, thanks so much for talking with us.
Terry, it's been a blast. Thank you very much.
Bill Flanagan's new satirical novel about television is called New Bedlam. He's an executive vice president of MTV Networks. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. From the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. And from Warner Home Video and Netflix, presenting Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, starring Patrick Stewart, Sarah Michelle Gellar, and Lawrence Fishburne. Available today on DVD at Netflix.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
You're right, I'm left, she's gone.
Coming up, we talk with singer and songwriter Teddy Thompson about his new album of country songs and about being the son of singer-songwriters Richard and Linda Thompson. And David Bianculli reviews new first-season DVD sets of Friday Night Lights and Heroes.
That she was not the one for me. You told me all. Our love was so wrong, but now I changed my mind, 'cause she broke the tie that bind, and I know that she never cared for me. Well, I thought I knew just what she'd do. Yeah, I guess I'm not so small. You tried to tell me all.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Two new NBC series are released on DVD today, the popular series Heroes and the less popular Friday Night Lights. TV critic David Bianculli is enthusiastic about both, but not for the same reasons.
Heroes and Friday Night Lights are very, very different series. I enjoy them both and watched every episode of each show last season, but they don't have much in common. Heroes is a fantasy drama framed in the style of a comic book. Its visual look is intensely graphic, and it's full of good guys and bad guys with emerging superpowers. Its standout characters include a high school cheerleader who's virtually indestructible. She can walk into a raging fire or throw herself from a tall tower, and a few seconds later, all her burns or broken bones have healed. Friday Night Lights is a drama rooted in real life. If TV hadn't sullied the term beyond belief, you could almost call it a reality show. It's set in a small town in Texas and tells of a high school football coach and his family and the young members of the football team and their families. It's a regular weekly drama about people who don't solve crimes or save lives. And in stark contrast to Heroes, one of its standout characters is a high school quarterback who is anything but indestructible. In the opening episode, he makes a hard tackle after an interception and ends up paralyzed from the waist down. What happens next, to him and to the team, becomes the central story of season one of Friday Night Lights. In adapting the book and movie for television, the producers wanted to cast unknowns and a lot of Texas locals as the high schoolers and to give them room to run like free-range actors. Scenes are shot with three cameras simultaneously, with no rehearsal or blocking. Scenes shot on the football field during games can have as many as 8 cameras running. Friday Night Lights looks like a documentary, and the dialogue and action seem totally natural, more like a John Cassavetes or Robert Altman movie than a standard TV drama. And as actors go, you couldn't find many better performers on TV last season than Kyle Chandler and Connie Britton, who play Eric and Tammy Taylor, the coach and his wife. Both actors were overlooked by the Emmy nominators this year, and both were robbed. And in this box set, even their deleted scenes are impressive. Here's one where Connie Britton, as Tammy, retreats from a dinner party and hides on the hallway stairs with a woman she's just met. Tammy's upset because of the severity of the injuries to the team's quarterback, and the woman listening to Tammy has provided her with a sympathetic ear and a few rounds of drinks.
You know what gets me is that here's a 17-year-old kid, and his whole life has just been completely altered, very possibly completely destroyed.
Right.
Lying in a hospital bed.
Right.
And I mean, that's his life, you know? That is his, that is everything. That is forever. His whole life. And and people are so upset about it, but you know what I think the sad truth is? I think people are upset about it because he's a good football player. And what are the values of that?
Yeah.
Do you know?
Yeah.
What does that mean? We care about him because he's got a good throwing arm.
Well, it's Texas.
I have to do something.
Well.
Something.
Well.
It's just opened my eyes.
Okay.
You know what it is? It makes me realize the value of life. It makes me realize how fragile life is.
Right. You know what?
What?
You're more screwed up than I am.
Remember, that was a scene that didn't make the final cut. Imagine how good the show itself is. Heroes is a wonderful DVD set, too. But here, I suspect, a lot of the people buying the set will have seen the episodes already. Heroes was one of TV's few hits last season, so for fans, diving into its Save the Cheerleader, Save the World storyline is more rediscovery than discovery. But it's the sort of series and story that holds up well to repeated viewing, and this DVD set is packed with an almost ridiculous amount of tantalizing extras. For starters, there's the original unaired 73-minute pilot by series creator Tim Kring. Darker than the one shown on NBC, and featuring an entire subplot about terrorists that was cut. Kring provides audio commentary on his original pilot, and it's a candid and very eye-opening discussion about what did and didn't work in creating his series. And other extras here, little documentaries on the special effects, the stunt work, and so on, add a lot. Artist Tim Sale, who supplies those pivotal drawings of the future, supposedly painted by the character of Isaac, gets a documentary of his own. He uses it, in part, to poke fun at the giant artist's loft that Isaac is shown inhabiting in New York.
Other than, Claire and HRG's house, it's the one set we've been in more, right, than any other. And I'm always amused by it. When I first saw it, it's that kind of, how does the Friends cast get to live in these, million-dollar lofts in New York? And that's sort of Isaac. I mean, where does he get his money to have a place like that? I want that studio. I'm talking to you from my garage, right? Which I love. But yeah, no, it's a really cool set.
These DVD collections of Heroes and Friday Night Lights are really cool sets, too. And the best news is that they come from Universal, which finally has changed its policy about how to package TV shows on DVD. It used to offer no extras at all, even on classic titles like Columbo, figuring that fans would buy the sets anyway. I don't know what changed their corporate minds, but I'm glad it happened in time for these two sets to be treated properly.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Coming up, Teddy Thompson talks about his new album of country songs and plays a song for us. This is Fresh Air. Teddy Thompson is a British singer-songwriter, but his new album doesn't feature his own songs. It features country songs, some classics, some lesser-known songs, and one original. The album's called Up Front and Down Low. Thompson is the son of singer-songwriter parents, Richard and Linda Thompson, who performed as a duo before separating when Teddy was young. Teddy's played and recorded with each of his parents, and he's performed with his good friend Rufus Wainwright. A little later, Thompson will perform a song for us from his new CD. Let's start with the opening track of the CD, Change of Heart, written by Felice and Budlow Bryant.
Well, I guess you must have had a change of heart. You don't treat me like you did at the
Teddy Thompson, welcome back to Fresh Air. I really like your new album a lot. Why did you want to do an album of country songs?
Career suicide. It's been described to me. There's a couple of answers, but the short answer is that I love country music, and that's what I grew up listening to, strange as it may seem. I grew up in England, but was obsessed with country music. So it's nearest and dearest to me.
How did you get obsessed with country music growing up in England? I know rockabilly was really big in England, but I'm not sure that country music per se was.
No, and not when I was a kid, not in the 80s. Neither of them were big. So, it was my parents. They listened to a lot of country music, specifically the Everly Brothers. We had a tape in the car that we wore out because we made my dad play it so many times, and I just loved it. It was the first music I heard that I remember just loving.
And what was it about the music, the melodies, and also the harmonies?
Yeah, I think that had a lot to do with it. It was the sweet sound of it, and the harmonies, and the instrumentation in that kind of country music is very sweet too. I mean, it's like saccharine sweet. You know, the sound of the pedal steel and the harmonies and everything just sounds luscious.
Now, did you grow up listening to your parents' records at all?
Not really. I mean, I certainly heard them in the background here and there, but I didn't like it when I was a kid. Very uncool. Well, I say very uncool, but then there was me listening to country music, but I didn't tell anybody that either. But my parents' music was so English and so stern and so straight ahead and so uncool is the word that keeps coming back to me. I don't feel that way now. I hated Dad, but you know, when I was 10, I just thought that was totally dorky.
Now, did everyone sing around the house, and did that help you feel unselfconscious about singing? Did singing seem natural? Because for some of us, singing is such a self-conscious and potentially embarrassing act if anybody's listening.
No, I mean, there wasn't a lot of singing around my house. It wasn't that, I didn't have that bohemian musical upbringing at all. My parents divorced when I was very young as well, so there were only a few years, really, where there was any music in the house, But there was a lot of great music being played and listened to, you know, which had a big effect on me. It was more like just having parents, well, mostly my mother, because that's who I was living with, having a mother with just great taste in music, and she wasn't really making records when I was growing up. So it was more like just having a great record collection and being exposed to great things rather than all singing around the piano or something.
And would she give you any feedback when you started to sing and play guitar?
Yeah, but you know, she's a mum, you know, and so most of her feedback was that everything was great. You're like, oh, you're so great, and she's still that way, which is the absolute best thing in the world. You know, that's a great thing to have. You know, to have a mother that's just encouraging and loving. So my dad was more practical with his advice. My mother was more unconditional love, you know.
And what was the practical advice he'd give you?
He'd say things like, you know, you should write some songs where you fingerpick and stop thrashing at the guitar and that sort of thing, you know, which, you know, he was right. Very, you know, very pragmatic, practical things like, you know, technical things like that. You're like, why don't you try writing a slow song where you finger pick it and see what happens? And it's good advice.
Did you learn to play guitar on your own? Were you taught in part by your father or by any of his friends when you were performing with him?
No. I took guitar lessons like everybody else. Because I was at the age when I wanted to start playing the guitar, I was living at my mum's, and you know, and my dad was, you know, mostly on tour for most of my childhood, which you know, is the way it goes in musical families. So he wasn't really around to teach me guitar. I'm not sure if I would have asked him to anyway. I thought it would, you know, I wanted to do it myself.
And what about the level of fame that you wanted for yourself? You know, like in your father's band, I mean, he has like this extraordinary and devoted following, but he's not like a huge star. Commercially. Mm. So what did you decide you wanted for yourself if you could choose, you know, when you were getting started? And how do you feel now about that?
I think when I was getting started, I probably wanted a little bit more. I craved a bit more success than I do now, but a big part of that was just the way that the record industry is laid out or was then. I made my first record about 6 years ago, and at that time, you know, I signed to a record label, a major record label, and they give you quite a lot of money, you know, and they expect a lot in return. You know, the level, the acceptable level of success is high. You know, I mean, what they expect you to sell in order to give that back to them is a bit daunting, and it's a terrible business model for developing artists. You know, you really have to sell a huge amount of records in order to succeed, and most people don't, and then you're, you know, dropped like a cold potato, hot potato, something cold, something cold and undesirable. So that made me want success, because I felt like I had to achieve success in order to be viable. But now I realize that that's not really the way it should be, and that's more a problem with the record industry. I'm certainly aware of the example of my dad as being a really good one. You know, having longevity and getting to make your own choices.
A song that you wrote that was on your previous album, Separate Ways, is written from the point of view of somebody who wants to be a big star and to shine so bright it hurts. Mm. Would you sing just like the first few lines of that and tell us where the lyric for this came from?
Yeah, I can't do the synthesizer part, but I'll mock it up on the guitar. I wanna be a huge star that hangs out in hotel bars. I wanna wake up at noon in somebody else's room. I wanna shine so bright it hurts.
So where did the inspiration for that lyric come from? Were you describing yourself or somebody else?
No, I was describing myself. I mean, you know, having said all that about fame and fortune, there's a huge part of me that, and I think most people, that would love to be rich and famous. Or maybe it's a small part of me. and a small part of everyone. That's people always, you know, people are desperate for fame, or they think they are. And I don't think musicians are any different than people that go, you know, go on TV just to be there for 5 minutes. You know, all of us crave it a little bit and think, oh, wouldn't that be great, you know, to have the money and the freedom and all that stuff. But of course, in reality, it almost certainly wouldn't be that way. I'm sure most of us, and I certainly wouldn't really like the reality of not being able to go out and do what you want and have people follow you and stuff. It must be awful. But so it's just that piece of me that wants it and yet doesn't want it at all.
My guest is Teddy Thompson. His new CD is called Upfront and Down Low. He'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is singer and songwriter Teddy Thompson. His new CD, Up Front and Down Low, features covers of country songs and one original. Well, I'm going to ask you to do another song from your new CD of country music songs, and the CD is called Up Front and Down Low. Would you perform the song Strangers, and tell us about the song and why you chose it?
Yeah, this is a Merle Haggard song. It's called Strangers. I think it's the full title is Strangers. Well, from now on, all my friends are going to be strangers. This is one of those country songs. There's another thing I was fascinated about by country music when I was a kid was the clever turn of phrase and the almost funny but funny sad turn of phrase. And this song has one of the best I've ever heard, which goes, from now on, all my friends are going to be strangers. The only thing I can count on now is my fingers, which is sort of comic tragedy, but it's heartbreaking at the same time, and I love it. So this song's called Strangers.
All the love you promised would be mine forever. I would have bet my bottom dollar on. Well, it sure turned out to be a short forever. Just once I turned my back and you were gone. From now on, all my friends are gonna be strangers. I'm all through ever trusting anyone. The only thing I count on now is my fingers. I was a fool believing you, and now you are gone. It amazes me not knowing any better than to think I had a love that would be true. Well, I should be taken out, torn and feathered, to have let myself be taken in by you. From now on, all my friends are gonna be strangers. I'm all through never trusting anyone.
That's Teddy Thompson performing a song that's also on his new CD. The new CD is an album of country songs. It's called Up Front and Down Low. Now, I know you went to boarding school. I've seen in movies and read it in novels like this image of, British boarding schools where there's nothing but hazings and the boys are really cruel to each other. Was your boarding school anything like that?
No, I was lucky. A lot of, especially Americans, tend to, they sort of gasp. It's, but Americans with kids, you know, they go, oh, I'd never send my child away to one of those places. Imagining just what you said, you know, the English, the austere grey buildings and the, you know, the sixth form boys whipping you. But no, I went to a famously liberal boarding school in England, which was actually the first co-ed boarding school in England. They were the first ones to have boys and girls together, whenever that was, in the 20s or something. So it's called Beedales, and it's a lot of very arty people send their kids there. So it was a great place to go. It was like camp, really.
Did it help you artistically to be at a school where a lot of children of artists were sent?
Yeah, it certainly did. I mean, there were no uniforms. We all just, you know, we all sort of walked around in our, you know, trying to look cool, in our sort of faux hippie duds. Everybody's trying to look poor, basically, which was seemed to be that right. Thing. To you had to try and look like you'd just woken up and, you know, you had no money and like, oh, I don't even know how I'm at this posh school. But everybody, you know, there was a big emphasis on music. Everybody was in a band, and I was in a band pretty quick when I got there. And there was a big art block. And to be honest, not much emphasis on maths and all that stuff. So it probably wasn't the place to go if you wanted to get into Oxford or Cambridge, but it was great for someone like me.
And what did you play in your band?
I played the guitar. I was the singer. I was, you know.
No, I mean, what kind of music? Was it covers?
Oh, what did we play? Really bad covers. We did, because they were sort of school dances. JFP, they were called. Which was an antiquated term for jazz, folk, and poetry. a long time ago at the school, but they didn't change the moniker. But by the time I was there, it was just everybody's rock band, you know, getting up for like a school dance. And we did covers of whatever was in the charts. So to try and curry favor, try and get popular. So we did like a Guns N' Roses song, and. I remember doing the Joker, Steve Miller song, because it was in a jeans advert that was very popular at the time.
Well, your new CD has a hidden track. And so it's a track that doesn't show up on the liner notes, and it doesn't, you know, it doesn't really register, though it shows up on my iPod as untitled.
Yes.
But it's really an Everly Brothers song. Tell us about the song and why you recorded it as a hidden track. Like, why not just, like, do it up front and officially include it? And I should mention that your previous album, Separate Ways, which mostly featured originals, also ended with a hidden Everly Brothers track.
As did my first record.
Oh. Definitely a pattern.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's silly now, but I did it on my first record, which my self-titled album. I did an Everly Brothers song. a duet with Emmylou Harris, and then, as you said, on my last record, on Separate Ways, I did a duet with my mother of an Everly Brothers song, and yeah, it was just sort of a recognition or a nod to my musical first love. I was just something that I wanted to do, and then I decided that I'd do it every time, that it'd be a fun thing to do a duet with somebody over the songs that I love, you know, on every record, and just shove it in the back. So I did this one, this Everly Brothers song with Jenny Moldauer, who's yet another kid of musicians. She's Maria Moldauer and Jeff Moldauer's daughter, and she's a good friend of mine and a great singer. So we did this song, and it's a little known Everly Brothers song, but it's a beautiful song, I think.
Well, why don't we close with it? And I want to thank you so much, Teddy Thompson, for talking with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
After all we've been to one another, how can we become like sister and brother? Darling, I beg of you, if our love must end, ask me to forget you, but don't ask me to be friends.
Teddy Thompson's new CD is called Upfront and Down Low. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menjivar. I'm Terry Gross.
I just couldn't be the friend you can find.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of the Aeneid, Virgil's epic of the founding of Rome, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to ensure that more students graduate from high school ready for college work and citizenship, gatesfoundation.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/freshair. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we do what public radio does best. Yes, we rock out. We begin our Labor Day weekend series on heavy metal and hard rock. Up first, Rob Halford of Judas Priest, who surprised his fans by coming out, and James Hetfield of Metallica, the band that hired a therapist to keep them together. Join us for the next Fresh Air.